Booker T and the MGs with his smash hit of 1962, Green Onions. Booker T. Jones was a mere 17 years old at the time. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. Well, we're going to be talking about two things today, but up first is the question of whether there's happy motoring in the automobile industry as we speak. Averting a midnight Sunday threatened strike by a mere 17 minutes, the United Auto Workers Union and General Motors announced a tentative agreement on a new four-year contract for about 52,700 workers. They now must vote on the deal, whether to accept it or whether to reject it. We have with us today veteran auto worker and a member of the bargaining committee, Gary Walkowitz, who says that worker solidarity is keeping both union leadership and corporate bosses in check. Thanks, Gary, for being with us today.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Fine, thank you. Well, the tentative agreement has been announced. How is it being received?
Well, first of all, I can't speak on the tentative agreement that's been reached with General Motors because they have not announced the details yet. I work at Ford. I've been a union activist and a union committee man for many years. All I can speak about at this point is the Chrysler contract because I assume that the Ford and General Motors contract will be similar because the union leadership always tried to follow a pattern agreement on the basics of the contract in terms of the basic wage structure, pensions, healthcare. There might be some differences in terms of bonus money or upfront money, but the basic structure of the General Motors and Ford contract I expect to be the same as what we have at Chrysler. And I'm totally opposed to that agreement at Chrysler. I don't think it nearly compensates the auto workers enough for what they've lost and what they should be getting paid in the future.
Well, yes, indeed. The absolute details of this tentative agreement, I've been looking. I haven't seen anything yet. Some things have been printed, but they're purely speculative. So we expect to have a full accounting or full presentation of what this contract, tentative contract agreement is. But I think you're right about that. It could be expected that this agreement will follow pretty much the same kind of parameters as the agreement worked out at Fiat Chrysler. And in that case, you say that, therefore, is not necessarily a good thing. What specifically would you say you would be upset about or you are beginning to be antsy about even now when the details are not yet known? What is the reaction that you're having now, and what is it based on?
Well, the first thing is that this contract does not get rid of the two-tier system. The two-tier system came in 2007, where it relegated the new hires to second-class citizenship, basically, and second-class standard of living by bringing people in at a lower wage rate. And not only that, they have a worse health care plan because they had to pay more out of pocket for their health care, and they have no pension. And so this contract at Chrysler, which allegedly was going to bridge the gap or eliminate the two-tier situation, in fact, in some ways made it worse because they created more tiers. Now, some of the second-tier workers were given some raises, which would get them up to first tier, and some of them, a few of them, by the end of the four-year contract, would actually be at the first-tier pay, but they will still not have a pension and still not have full health care. And for the rest of the second-tier workers at Chrysler, the majority of them still will not be at first-tier pay at the end of the contract, which means there's no guarantee that they will ever get there, because you have to renegotiate every 4 years, of course. The second piece of it, if you look real closely at the Chrysler contract, it actually creates some new lower tiers at certain workplaces like parts depots, and it creates an opening for the company to hire more temporary workers at an even lower pay rate. And temporary workers are used not just on occasion, but are used year-round. So I think instead of going in the direction of eliminating the two-tier situation, we've actually made it worse in some ways. And that's the first thing I'm opposed to in this what they have at Chrysler, is because it perpetuates and even in some ways worsens the situation of separate tiers within the UAW.
But just the same, the Fiat Chrysler workers, it took them 6 weeks really to ratify that contract, which means they had huge problems with it. We still are hearing wonderful noises coming out of Detroit that averting the strike was such a good thing, and it's supposed to signify progress. It's supposed to signify that the union leadership and the management are pretty much on the same team now. They've worked hard to negotiate and so forth, and everything is being done in good faith. But The activity so far suggests that workers are still quite suspicious about what is going on behind closed doors when the negotiations are going on. Are you getting any sense still that even as this new agreement is announced, this one being the second agreement, the third to go would be the one at Ford, we'll get to that in a minute, but are you getting a sense from workers that they still are not happy with what is going on with the union leadership?
Absolutely. I think it goes back, and it's something that goes back a number of years now, to maybe a decade or so, where we've had a series of contracts and reopened contracts that forced concessions on workers, and the union leadership, you know, really promoted and supported and in some cases pressured and even threatened workers to try to get those contracts ratified and passed. I think there's a lot of resentment among the rank and file workers that they feel that the top leadership of the UAW is not really on their side, that they more consider themselves partners with the corporate bosses rather than advocates for the workers. And so, yes, there's certainly a matter of a lot of suspicion and really a lot of unhappy workers. I can clearly tell you that people where I work at, but I have, you know, I know a lot of auto workers in different factories also, who feel that the union leadership does not really represent what they want to see happen and does not really speak for them and advocate what they're really looking for.
Well, some people think, outside of the industry, some people would think, many people would think that, hey, this is a great job. Auto workers have nothing to complain about because compared to other industries, auto workers are paid a really higher rate of pay. They have a lot more benefits. And basically, they're just being a bit, you know, greedy and prima donna-ish because compared to other industries, you have it pretty good. So what's all the belly aching about? Could you give us a sense? I don't want you to get too detailed with your personal life, but could you give us a sense as to in what ways your experience as a worker, what is the kind of financial situation that you are experiencing as a worker today compared to other years or previous years? And is the change for better or for the worse? How do you explain to people on the outside, listen, no matter what you're hearing, life is tough as an auto worker. And it doesn't have to be because the industry is making more money now than they have in years.
Okay, the first thing I would say is if anybody wants to look at the pay of auto workers, then let's look at the pay of the people we work for, okay? The CEOs, the people who own the corporations, the investors who profit off of our labor, and look at how much money they're making, first of all, off the work we do. Secondly, the auto workers, if anybody wants to come to an auto plant and the assembly line and try working it, and see what work, how hard auto workers have to work under so much stress, I would invite them to try the job out. You look at the fact that, and not just auto workers, I'm not going to just speak on the UAW workers, but also workers in factories in general. Look at just statistically what their lifespan is. It's very clear that you live a shorter life if you're in the factory for 30 years. That's exactly true. So, but another point I want to speak upon is where they want to compare auto workers to other workers, and I'm going to say other workers are underpaid too, and maybe even more so than we are. I don't try to differentiate that we're auto workers, other people are steel workers, work in the hospital, they're teachers. Working people in general, I think, are not compensated enough for the work that they do. And I think I would advocate that all of us need to get a raise. All of us need to get more benefits. All of us need to have a better standard of living than what we have right now. And we see a deterioration across this country of workers in general. Their standard of living has gone down. Our wages have gone down. We're paying more for our health care. At the same time, we see a growing wealth in this corporation, in this country, where the corporate wealth is increased, and it is reflected in the disparity of wealth between the rich and the poor in this country. And all work is just one part of that big picture.
So, as a worker, I mean, I was shocked to learn that some workers are actually earning in the range of about $13 an hour. And I was shocked about that because my own perception was that can't be right, because this is the auto industry. This is the industry that made Detroit. This is the industry that set the standard, as a matter of fact, within the manufacturing industry as to what was considered a good job and a job with equity and so forth. So when I read that many workers are earning at a rate of $13 an hour, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, it's very true what you're saying. All those workers work in parts plants. Some of them work for less than $13 an hour. What you've seen over the years is that the auto companies, which used to produce directly their own parts, have outsourced a lot of the work to companies. Sometimes they might even control or have part ownership in these other corporations who make the parts. And the workers in these parts factories make even less money than the workers in the assembly plants or the main assembly factories for the auto companies. So they're certainly part of the auto industry too. There are many auto workers who work in small parts places. They might even be represented by the UAW, but they are making $15 an hour and $13 an hour and $11 an hour, and not even close to having a living wage, certainly not a wage you can raise a family on. And they're part of the auto industry, too, and they're part of the workforce that I think is being exploited by the auto companies.
One of the good things that seems to have come out of the first round of negotiations with Fiat Chrysler is that the older workers who were paid at a higher rate because of this two-tiered system and the younger workers seem to have forged an alliance, which is rare because the tactic usually is you pit one against the other. Yes. How did this come about? Do you think that this was a significant development within the last round of negotiations with the Fiat Chrysler?
Yes, I think that was important. The vote at Chrysler, that strong no vote, came from both first-tier workers and second-tier workers, and I think they understand better than they did, you know, maybe a year or two ago, the fact that our fates are linked together, okay, that having two-tier divides us and makes all of us weaker. That I think it's no coincidence that since the two-tier system started, auto workers, the first-tier workers, had not had a raise at all in the last 10 years. It's not a coincidence. And once they divided us, it was easier for the corporation to underpay both the first and second tier workers. So I think people better understand that issue now. And in my factory, in my plant, I can see more. Even the first tier workers maybe didn't think the second tier workers' problems had anything to do with them. I think they realize more now that we are linked together. We have to have an alliance together and make sure we're on the same page, and that we cannot be divided. We cannot be divided. And it only puts us in a weaker position and puts the corporation in a strong position. So, yes, I think the Chrysler vote reflects a better understanding among all workers, now whether you're first tier or second tier, that we have to be united in solidarity.
Do you happen to know what came of the proposal, or the at least the rumor was that at least 500 would have been laid off of the GM plant in Lake Orion. Do you know what happened there?
Not sure the details. They were just announced recently that they're going to lay some people off, and I'm not sure exactly the reasons for the layoff. Other than they say slow sales, but it's again a reflection. They've tried to sell us in the South, meaning the union leadership and the corporate, to try to sell workers by saying, well, if you go along with concessions or not getting raises or not as big a raise, we'll have more jobs for you. But the number of jobs in the auto industry is really not based on how much we're paid. It's totally based on sales. It's based on what vehicle you're building and how it's selling. And jobs go up and down based on that. So, it just shows that whatever promises the companies make, if they want to lay you off because the vehicle's not selling, they're going to lay you off.
Well, Ford, the company that you work for, is going to be the last of the big three to enter into negotiations. As a member of the committee that is looking into how to approach this question and how to basically look at the actions of the UAW as it negotiates with Ford, what is it shaping up to be, and what are the concerns at Ford for you?
Okay. Well, first of all, I'm not, just to clarify, I'm not on the, my position as a bargaining committee man, I'm not on the national, the negotiating committee, so I don't do that bargaining for our national contract. I bargain for our local contracts. So I'm not privy to what's being discussed by our top leadership, in the closed door, behind closed doors in terms of what's going to be, negotiated for this, for the Ford contract. All I can say is that based on what our leadership has said, based on what Dennis Williams has said, I expect that what would be negotiated with Ford will be very similar to what was negotiated at Chrysler, and certainly very similar to what's being negotiated or has been negotiated right now at General Motors. So I'm expecting a similar type contract.
And therefore, what would be the main sticking points as negotiations approach?
Well, again, the way I look at it, the first thing, we'd have to completely dismantle the two-tier system, bring everybody up to first-tier pay, first-tier benefits, first-tier pension. That should be the number one priority. Secondly, when we have a workforce here, first-tier workers who have not had a raise for 10 years, I think it's important to not just get a couple raises. I think yearly raises used to be standard in the auto industry. Cost of living used to be standard. The union years ago fought for cost of living, so that if prices go up, your pay can go up to compensate for the higher prices. I think those things are crucial. And I think all those things are important in this contract and need to be there, as far as I'm concerned, to have a contract that I can support. And the other piece is there's concern about the health care. There's some language in our existing contracts at GM, Ford, and Chrysler, which leaves the door open for change to be made in our health care after contracts have been settled and ratified. The leadership of the union and the company can agree on changes that would impact people's health care. I think we cannot take any step backwards in terms of health care, whether it costs you in terms of more money out of pocket or it limits your choices for doctors or hospitals that you can go to. So I think that's the third crucial piece that we have to have. We cannot leave the door open for any, we cannot give a blank check for any changes in our health care after our contract is ratified.
Is there any talk at this point throughout the union and throughout the workers' union, I should say, is there any talk of taking on the leadership once the dust settles a little bit, that there needs to be some kind of a revisiting here of the role of the leadership in negotiating all three of these contracts, which basically affect 141,000 workers?
Well, I think it's a crucial issue within our union. I think that any direction, change of direction in our union is going to have to come. I think it's going to have a movement from the rank and file, from below. My opinion is I think our top leadership is too wedded to their idea of partnership with the corporation, so I think it's going to take a change from the rank and file. Is there something that can point right now movement on that those lines? I can't say there is, but I think that day could be coming. There are certainly a few of us in the union, even in local leadership positions, who have opposed the top leaders. And a lot of the rank and file agree with what we're saying. So a change needs to be made. That is clear in my mind, and I think it will come. It will be, the day change is coming. I just can't tell you when it's going to happen.
You're in Michigan. I'm in Florida. Other people are all over the country. Why should we care about what's going on here?
Well, I think if you're an ordinary person, a working person, unless you're a CEO or one of the wealthy 1% of this corporation, I think what happened, you know, we all are in the same situation wherever we work at as a working person. Like I said, if you're a teacher, if you're a construction worker, if you're an auto worker, a steel worker, you're working in McDonald's or in a fast food industry or in a hospital, you know, as a working class in this country, you know, we are all under attack. And we should not let ourselves be divided and think that what happens to auto workers have nothing to do with what happens to teachers or vice versa. I think they have us divided just as they have us divided within our union between first and second tier. They have us divided between different workplaces, different corporations. But I think it's important for people to see, you know, the UAW for many years took a leadership position in within the labor movement and fought for things and helped grab the whole labor movement forward. They've helped bring the standard of living up of workers across this country. And I think that's the reason what happened to the UAW is important. But we're all part of this. We're all part of the same working class in this country, wherever we work at. And so I think we have to see what happens to other workers. What happens to one affects all of us. I think that's the important thing that I hope people understand.
Have you, Gary, personally undergone any kind of a change of political awareness in this last round? I mean, I'm sure that you have had many of these sentiments for quite a while, but is there something particularly jarring in this round of negotiations that even intensified your views?
Well, I think, I'm not sure it changed my views as much, but I think if people look at what's happening here, that the fact that we negotiate a contract and say it's a good contract when we can't even get back to the level where we're at 10 years ago, for the last decade or so, it's been the issue where we were told as auto workers that the company's not doing as well, the profits are down, so we have to give things up, okay? But the idea was when things got better, we'll get them back. I never really bought into that idea because I knew the corporates would hold on to every penny we gave them. But that was a sell job that we were told. And now the fact we're in a situation where we're negotiating another contract where we've had the last 4 years, the auto companies have made, you know, very, very high profits, record profits, okay? And yet we cannot even get back to the level of contract we had 10 years ago. That's very striking. I think people need to understand that what they're really doing here is bringing down a permanent, that's what they want. They're intending to bring a permanent lowering of a standard of living for auto workers in this country. And I think that's a significant part of this contract.
Well, I want to thank you, Gary, for joining us today, bringing us up to snuff on this issue of what's happening within the auto industry to workers in the industry, and also for being our guide. You gave us a little bit of a lesson here on labor relations in the middle of all of this. So I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Thank you. We'll take this break and come back right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. And we're picking up from where we left off yesterday. I got inundated with emails and folks wanting to express themselves based on yesterday's program. And yesterday, as you recall, we talked about the great big break that Hillary Clinton got during the so-called Benghazi hearings in Congress last week. She basically is still basking in the glow of her triumph at the hearing on the attack of two mysterious U.S. diplomatic compounds in Benghazi, Libya, on September the 11th, 2012, that left four Americans dead, among them Ambassador Christopher Stevens, Foreign Service Information Management Officer Sean Smith, and CIA contractors Tyrone Woods and Glenn Doherty. The exercise yesterday was that listeners were putting themselves on the panel of inquiry and pretending that Hillary Clinton is before us, available for questioning finally on this matter of her role in the attacks. She was Secretary of State at the time. She is, of course, you know, a presidential candidate. And we were asking questions that appeared not to have been asked. And they're not very complicated questions, very basic questions. So we were discussing why it was that none of the basic questions were asked at all. And they had Hillary Clinton, after a series of postponements and legal battles as to whether she should or shouldn't testify, or when and under what conditions she would testify, that she would make herself available. So there she was, finally, before not just this committee, but before the nation. And nobody asked the basic questions. And of course, we began to determine why. Michael yesterday and Michael from New Jersey, Khalil from South Carolina, together they came up with one incredible question. What was the reason for Ambassador Stevens being there at the time? Since, of course, as Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton was the boss of all ambassadors. That she was clearly in a position to know why he was there. What was he doing there? What was this compound? In fact, there were two. The attack took place at two compounds that were variously called. At one point, they said these were consulates. At another point, these were U.S. missions. At another point, they were just diplomatic compounds. Nobody's quite sure what to call them. Because according to the State Department, the United States doesn't have a diplomatic compound now or even then in Benghazi. The consulate, the official consulate, is located in Tripoli. So what is this compound? Why were they there? What does Hillary Clinton know? So we continue with the questions. And this is what I would ask you to do. Just frame the question as if you were the questioner, because you are. You're asking Hillary Clinton questions that this committee, which said it is dedicated to finding out the truth about the Benghazi attack, what are the questions that need to be asked of Hillary Rodham Clinton? And why aren't these questions being asked? So you will frame your response in the form of a question. Secretary Clinton, you begin it that way. Secretary Clinton, and then you start your question. So we'll know what the question is. The reason we're doing this is, of course, it's to illustrate the point that we come to time and again, and that is that people are very much ahead of the game here. Very, very often, the games that are being played out at this high level, and this was one of the instances in which the game was played out at a very high level, and the game was to persuade the country and the world that the United States was engaging actively in this process called democracy, because we have nothing to hide. We are transparent and we are above board and we are interested in the truth wherever it shall fall. But is that what we got? Is that really what happened here? Do we know the truth? Was Mrs. Clinton asked anything that approximated the truth? Did anybody even get close to asking a question that seemed to suggest they were interested in the truth of what happened at Benghazi? No, we got a lot of stuff about the red, white, and blue, and a lot of patriotic jargon, and we got the emotion of doing these things in the name of the families and certainly of the victims of these two different but related attacks occurring within hours of each other. But we are concerned, are we not, that we had the top person in the country deliberately being directed off course, because it seemed as if, and this is just my feeling, I have no definitive proof about it, but based on how these kinds of things go, what happens prior to Hillary Clinton appearing before this committee and acting as if, well, here I am, I have nothing to hide, I have no fear of facing the American people. There's a lot of wrangling that goes on behind closed doors. And the wrangling has to do with what she will not be asked. And nobody, whether Democrat or Republican, will ask it. Do not ask these questions, and then we're good to go. So, 888-874-4888 is the number to call. And let's continue that discussion from yesterday. You are asking questions, various questions, of Hillary Clinton, the former Secretary of State and current presidential candidate, with regard to this hot topic of what really happened in Benghazi and what was her role. What are the questions that someone interested in determining the truth of it, and certainly her role here, what kinds of questions would a person have asked? You don't have to be the elected official like Trey Gowdy, who was chairman of this committee, or Elijah Cummings, who the congressman from Maryland, who threw himself on the sword to just to block the attacks on her as he perceived them. You just have to be a citizen. And what we have discovered just yesterday, people are way ahead of the game, but it's important that we express these things. 888-874-4888. Now, let me start out with a missive from Emmanuel Washington, who was one of the people who emailed. And here's what he said. As to the overarching questions not broached during the Benghazi hearings, I think that the CIA intrigues surrounding Ambassador Stevens is part of an overall assumption of America's overt and covert right to disregard, by any means necessary, the integrity of any sovereign state that does not neatly fall into its free market, democratic liberalism orbit. Madam Secretary, do you take full responsibility for your role in crafting U.S./Libyan policy and Gaddafi's subsequent fall? Madam Secretary, do you shoulder any responsibility for the failed nation state that Libya has become, for the sanctuary its dissolution now offers to hordes of terrorists, as well as contributing to the millions of refugees now streaming into Europe? How about that? Great question. From Los Angeles, Ron, you're on the air. What's your question of Hillary Rodham Clinton?
Well, my question is basically in follow-up to one of the members. I think he was a congressman from Illinois, and he basically got Hillary Clinton to admit that she was directly responsible for assassination of the past president Gaddafi. Now, given that admission, it happens to be here in the year 2000. This is my question to Hillary. Are you aware that killing an elected government official of a foreign nation is a federal criminal act under United States code? And therefore, you are, you've committed a crime punishable by a life imprisonment under the criminal court as well as the United States court. Please respond.
Well, you did kind of ask a kind of closed question. In a sense, she would simply say yes or no to that. Could you take that same question that you just asked, just tweak it a little bit, so that you give no room for just a simple yes or no? What, therefore, would the question sound like?
Well, I would, I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but I do recall, and it's a YouTube video now. I would just recite what she just testified to the congressman from Illinois, where she admitted that, yes, we were plotting to kill Gaddafi. And, that was our goal. And we accomplished that. And also, the fact that now you have a nation where, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of innocent people, and in particularly, black people of Libya were specifically targeted for, assassination under your doing. And so again, all these war crimes on the level of Hitler and exterminating the Jews, et cetera, are you aware of it? This action on your part is a war crime.
Now, why was that question, in your view, not asked?
Well, I think, as you're kind of alluding to, there's a certain amount of acceptance of America being able to bully countries all over the world, let alone a country that is not as militarily as powerful as the United States. There's that, you know, agreement between both Democrats, Republicans, liberal, conservative. There's that understanding. But the thing I really kind of liked about the hearing is, given that the Republicans want to get at the Democrats however they can, there was a certain level of quote-unquote justifiable disrespect that the Republicans on the committee had for Hillary. Oh, they disrespected her. And but it was very legitimate in that, does she deserve respect? No. So she don't get respect. And then if you kind of follow up on that, the media, both liberal and conservatives, have kind of distanced themselves from that committee hearing because they came raw. Those Republicans came raw. And the only thing that this Uncle Tom from Maryland, he was Mr. Uncle Tom of all time. Oh, this is, we're better than this. And we're, he had no substance to the comeback because there is no defending the indefensible, right? Only thing, oh, we're better than this. We're better. Blah, 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 blah. Well, what is he saying? Nothing. Why? Because he can't say nothing. But again, in terms of the media protected all this. And if you turn on the TV today, oh, Hillary's on a roll and she did so great. She won the election. The only thing, my conclusion on all that propaganda that's constantly being spewed right now, America is in trouble.
All right.
America and America.
I think you gave us a really good perspective here on that particular question. And it is a very legitimate question about war crimes. Now, you see, the thing is, you have a former first lady. She's also Secretary of State, former Secretary of State. She's now a candidate for president of the Democratic Party and seeking the nomination of the Democratic Party. They can't have, they just won't have anything like war crimes, anything like you just raised, associated with somebody like this. Not when media have decided that she is doing so well.
Scary.
She needs to be supported. You have Elijah Cummings pretty much saying, beating up. And
looking
look at
like
you,
a
you're
clown.
Sitting there. He actually said, you're sitting there by yourself, Madam Secretary. I wish I could jump over this barrier and sit right next to you and put my arm around you because you're just the beating up on you because you're a woman and you're a strong woman and all the
yeah.
Can't have
scary.
These negatives associated with her at this point,
and
because the fixed already was in. These topics, the question you raised was off limits. It was not to be raised within the context of this hearing. So you're absolutely on point on that. Thank you so much. Thanks, Ron, for your call today. Okay. Great.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. 888-874-4888. We are consistent. If you notice, we are consistent. Listeners are consistent in honing in on these very basic questions. And these are serious questions. These are serious questions because the issue of Benghazi, as we know, it's not just about these attacks that claimed the lives of four people. It is also about the role of the United States under the supervision and the authority of Hillary Rodham Clinton. We just heard a damning question that used a very important word, which is war crimes. Now, does Hillary Clinton look to you as she conducts her campaign? Does Hillary Clinton look to you based on the way the media have been covering Hillary Clinton and Benghazi and other things? Does Hillary Clinton look to you like a war criminal? No. She is the person who's, she's a fierce, strong woman in her pearls, and she's making really good sense, and she's got all of that stuff. Not at all associated with war crimes. Not at all. 888-874-4888. These are the things that we need to be discussing, because if you were to leave it up to the major media to make up your mind for you, look at the distance between the reality they present, and they covered this thing nonstop for, you know, almost the entire day. Nonstop coverage. And it's not just CNN and MSNBC, it's all the major media, a barrage of coverage. But which of these media organizations lifted out for public inspection the flip side of this coin? No, they too followed their orders. Their orders are, you are not going to go beyond your boundaries. Of course, CNN has all of the ammunition, all of the intellectual ammunition and the expertise, and the New York Times, they all have all the stuff available to them to decipher and to contextualize what was happening there and why it is important to raise these questions. But they will not do it because, one, they have a vested interest in maintaining a good relationship with the very agencies and organizations that they ought to scrutinize. Number two, there's a lot of money to be made here, and they're not about to jeopardize any of it. From New York, Ali, what was your question to Hillary Rodham Clinton?
Yes, the first thing that I had to say, I just wanted to say hello to you and to all the listeners. And I just wanted to mention that yesterday I couldn't really listen to your whole program, but I listened a little bit to what the Republican senator had to say, and of course the Democrats. But I didn't know how many people answered your question. But I will have to say this: one of the things that I heard from that Republican was that this country is exceptional. And another thing that I heard from the Democrat is like the wonderful Madam Secretary. That's why he was referring to that wonderful woman who was sitting there. And my question to her would have been, where was the CIA, the former CIA, Petraeus, what was he doing at that time, and what he knew about what was happening in that annex? And that would have been my
General
question.
Petraeus, who was the head of the CIA and previously, of course, a top military man. Why would you ask that question?
I wanted to know his involvement because, remember one thing, this man, look how Chelsea Manning is in right now in jail. Look how Assange, you like it or not, how he is in that embassy. And then you see all these whistleblowers that they had gone to jail. And this man had given classified information to a woman that he had an affair with. And he didn't go to jail. Actually, as a matter of fact, I protested right in front of the place where he was teaching in the city school.
But Ali,
yeah, but I just wanted to say, yes, I wanted to know what he knew on his involvement with her about what happened in Libya. That's what I would like to know from her, her involvement and Patrea's involvement, because Patrea is a criminal, just like her.
All right. Well, you kind of you saved yourself a little bit by connecting back to her and not just focusing on him, because the question is, she is there. She is before the committee. She is before the nation. So you have a one shot of asking a question that has not yet been asked, let alone answered. And your question would have been, did she coordinate with General Petraeus with respect to what in Benghazi?
I will connect it with everything. I will connect it with the so-called ambassador who was killed, and the four other people that were killed with him, and what they were doing at very late at night in that annex that has nothing to do with him, because I thought he was an ambassador. What he was doing there, and I would like to know her knowledge, and I would like to know her involvement, because like we know, she wants to be a general. When she talks about war, she's a warmonger. So I would like to know what she knew about her involvement on that organization and what he was doing that night that he was in there. That's what I would like for her to answer.
Okay, and now that you have asked a question, because part of the reason for asking a question is one supposes you know either the entire answer or you know a good part of the answer. What is the answer?
The answer to me, my answer is that man who was that ambassador who was murdered, we know that he has something to do with the death of Gaddafi. So if he has something to do with when he was sodomized and killed, she has something to do with it too at the same time. Like I said, she's a warmonger. So therefore, she has a lot of knowledge that she could give us. But of course, none of those guys want this information to come out. Republican and Democrats is the same thing. Like Tariq Ali said, we only need a new face, and that's what people are voting for. It's just to take out one face and put out somebody else there.
That's true. So true. Thank you, Ali, for your call today. Again,
okay, thank you.
We are on point. We are on point. We're asking very good questions. We are asking very, very good questions. But these questions will never surface in an official capacity, certainly not like the type of hearing that we had that supposedly was after the truth of the Benghazi attacks. But here we have the top official in that department, the Department of State. She was former Secretary of State. She's now a presidential candidate and touting her credentials, in fact, her capability and her accomplishments as Secretary of State as one of the reasons, the key reason that she should be elected. And in the middle of all of this, one would think that some kind of question relating to what was the purpose of those two compounds that are not consulates, they're not U.S. missions, they're not U.S. diplomatic compounds. What were they? What does she know? Why was the ambassador there? Why would these CIA contractors be there? What exactly was this about? And how much does she know about it? What kind of clearance did she give to Ambassador Stevens to do whatever it is he was assigned to do? And what was that assignment? What was he doing so far away from a consulate? especially in an area that is known to be so, quote, hostile, unquote, and unsafe. What was he doing there? What was occurring in these compounds? And this is all pertinent because this is under her watch. He was functioning as her, she was functioning as his boss. He was accountable directly to her. And she cannot possibly claim that she has no recollection of what he was doing there, or she had no knowledge of what he was doing there. She can't possibly claim that these so-called diplomatic compounds that are paid for by taxpayer money to operate, to maintain, that somehow she had no clue about these compounds. What were they there for? And that the questions being raised are just the beginning. If people wanted to understand what was going on at Benghazi or why the attacks, it seems to me that one should understand why did these compounds exist. And it seems to me it would have been a beautiful moment to have Hillary Rodham Clinton explain to, quote, the American people, which they call the rest of us, to explain to the American people what the U.S. presence, the very presence of the U.S. at a diplomatic level or covert level in Benghazi and in Libya at that time was. What was the program being pursued there at that time under her direct watch? What was the purpose of the ambassador being away from the embassy in Tripoli and instead hiding out in this very obscure area, which was said to be so hostile? What are you doing there? And how long have you been doing what you've been doing? So good questions were asked today. Excellent questions. And I think this is the way we need to go. We have to, because the media are just not doing that job. We can consider that this was a case in which everybody participated in the cover-up, especially including the media. The Democrats, as outraged as they were outraged because their standard bearer in this upcoming presidential race they viewed as being under assault. And it was clear Elijah Cummings, the ranking member of this committee, was given a task. Just fight. Just go to bat for her, and you just fight the Republicans tooth and nail, and at the same time recast this discussion, because now this discussion becomes the emails. On the Republican side, we have a supposedly tested and experienced former prosecutor, Trey Gowdy of South Carolina, chairing this committee, who can't seem to understand how to build a case. One would think that with all of his experience, his prosecutorial experience, he knows how to build a case. But if you're saying to people at this stage that the issue is about Hillary Clinton's emails and not about Hillary Clinton's function, and we have people here calling in today talking things like war crimes, talking about the assassination of a sovereign leader, we're talking about the arming of rebels within a country in order to foment the kind of violence that we see now to completely tear this country apart, and that was in fact the role, and it was Hillary Clinton who was in direct control over that program in concert with others. This person who shows up with her pantsuits and her pearls, we have somebody said today, is a war criminal and should have been asked about that. But nowhere would you find any intention, no intention whatsoever, to really begin to ask the questions. And if not the elected officials who are supposedly safeguarding democracy are not asking it. The media certainly are not asking this question at all. They're not in it. Their thing is, it's about a hearing. We're dealing with the hearing, and we're dealing with the polls and how she's doing in the polls and how the Republicans are attacking the Democrats and how the Democrats are attacking the Republicans. And that's the extent to which we are going to go. Suddenly, they don't have either the expertise or even the will to look beyond the obvious. They can't go beyond it because they were told that's not what you're supposed to do. Just stay well within the parameters given us, and we will tell the people, we will let them know. This is all about her emails. Well, clearly it's not. So I want to thank you very much for reassuring America today that we have some brains. We're not that crazy. We're not that one-dimensional. And we are not to be taken for granted as people who can't and won't think. Thank you so much for contributing to the discussion today. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Infectious Myth with David Crow. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. And as always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. You don't want to miss tomorrow's program, is all I'm going to tell you. Bye-bye.